well-regulated militia be necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Thank you so much for tuning in to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. I'm a little off-center here. Hang on one second. Let me do the... look at that. There we go. Much better. Thank you again for tuning into the program. Got a good show for you today. We're going to get to a lot of your emails. It's been a while since we've had sort of a mailbag Friday edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company, so we will do that today, but... we're also going to have an interview as well. I ran across a story, I guess this was Wednesday, and I was just fascinated by this because I'd never heard of this organization. It's called CCL Shul Members. And it's basically a group of Jewish gun owners in the Chicagoland area who are getting together on a regular basis to train, basically to protect their synagogues, their shuls, their houses of worship. And I just thought this was a fascinating story and a great story as well. So I had the opportunity to sit down mere moments ago with Chaim Nadich, who is the founder of the CCL Shul Members. And I want you to take a look and a listen to our interview with Chaim. Well, Chaim, thank you so much, sir, for coming to the program. It's really a pleasure talking with you today.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. And, you know, I do a lot of internet searches as I'm looking for things to write about. And so I ran across, frankly, a website that I'd never run across before, COLlive.com, and the headline, Chicago Jews Trained to Defend Shuls Responsibly. And this was all about the group CCL Shul Members, which you founded there in the Chicagoland area. Tell us a little bit about the group and why you felt like there was a need for this organization.
Sure. So we started 4 years ago after the shortly after the concealed carry law was passed in Illinois. As you may be aware, Illinois was the last state in the union to allow concealed carry.
Yep.
But all of a sudden, we had concerned, responsible congregants wanted to protect, you know, of course, pro Second Amendment, as well as wanted to protect themselves, family, and fellow congregants. So all of a sudden, we had a mass onslaught. I won't say mass onslaught. We had a lot of people in what I call dangerous, legally dangerous. So all of a sudden, now they have their concealed carry license, and they're basically minimally trained. So we saw the niche for additional training, and that's how we founded. That's how we started. So we really ramped up our training from indoor ranges to outdoor ranges, dynamic training. We're in the process of doing simulations as well as computerized simulation training through, you've probably seen it at the shows, where you use blowbacks and lasers. That's incredible training, as well as the simulations too, because you get proficient in the range, and all of a sudden now you put somebody in a high-stress environment where you have actors, noise, all the stimulus, and the outcome cannot be the greatest. We saw in the church shooting, we saw two people that were shot. My opinion, they definitely weren't the trained ones. The gentleman that took the 40-foot shot, incredible shot, obviously he had a tremendous amount of training. So that's a great indication. That's a great example of what training can do for someone in general as well as a congregation.
You know, have you seen an increase in folks reaching out to you after things like the shooting in White Settlement, Texas, or the attack over Hanukkah in New York State? Do these events drive interest in what you're doing?
Unfortunately, yes. Not only that, but we were kind of training in the shadows, what I call it. Mm-hmm. Basically, our group has come out of the closet, for lack of a better word. We live in a very anti-Second Amendment state, a blue state, and now people are realizing that, you know, when seconds count, police, who we love, are only minutes away. We are the first responders, like it or not. So people understand that the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy.
And you know, what about the attitude that we've seen from, you know, anti-gun politicians like Michael Bloomberg, who said that, you know, well, Jack Wilson shouldn't have had a gun in that church sanctuary, that the answer is more gun control laws instead of ensuring that, you know, a congregation, synagogues, gurdwaras, whatever house of worship we're talking about, that the folks inside have the ability to protect themselves if need be.
Bad guys don't follow laws.
Simple as that.
Simple as that.
And so what has the response been among rabbis and you know, religious leaders there in the Chicagoland area? I mean, you talk about the anti-gun attitudes that I think are fairly prevalent, but is your organization being embraced? And is this something that, you know, religious leaders are taking seriously?
I think it's a slow process. Mm-hmm. I think actually we were viewed as cowboys. And I kind of challenge that opinion. Everything we do is above the board. We are extremely fortunate enough to have top trainers in the state. Dan Lombard with Dava Defense is a police trainer of the top trainers. He utilizes some great trainers. Pete Millenios, a former SWAT trainer for Chicago PD 10 years. We are public. Everything we do is well above the board. Extremely fortunate to have this quality training. Encourage anyone who is interested, come to our events. We're open to the public. So we're prejudged, I think, by some people.
Mm-hmm.
Now that we're actually have a foothold in the training section of this area, I think it's just starting to come around. People realizing that if you don't make a decision, if you take the policy of don't ask, don't tell, you're making a decision, basically. So if you don't support us, you're against us.
Yeah. Well, the website is cclshulmembers.org. And right now this is limited to the Chicago area. Do you have plans to or would you like to see this, I think, grow into a national movement?
We've been approached by members from South Virginia, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. Quite honestly, we're swamped. We have so much stuff going on here. We just can't handle the workload. It takes a great dedication, a lot of time and effort to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we encourage people to do this, but not at this point.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, thank you for everything that you're doing. Thanks for spending a couple of minutes with us. And cclshulmembers.org. You say that you have meetings monthly that are open to the public. What do folks need to know before they show up?
Nothing.
Okay. Just bring themselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, listen, thank you so much for spending some time with us. I'd love to check back in with you maybe in a few months and just see how things are going.
Sounds good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir. I will definitely be checking in with Haim here in a couple of months. And I love the real grassroots nature of this, right? Just an organization springing up locally, doing what they can to ensure that folks are getting the training that they need. I'm impressed, and I want to see where this organization is here in just a few months. Right now, though, I would like to check in with you. We have a lot of emails that we have racked up here over the past couple of weeks, and I have not had much of an opportunity to get to some of these emails. So let's check in with what is on your mind. Juan in Round Hill, Virginia, writing in about grandfather clauses. And he says, I just wanted to point out, it's important to let your viewers know that were these gun control laws with grandfather clauses to pass, they in essence sell our children and our children's children's constitutional rights down the river. I think many people unfortunately hear grandfather clause and think, oh, okay, I can keep mine. Well, our children's natural born God-given rights are not ours to regulate away. I love your show and thanks for all you do. Ron, thank you, sir. For writing in and for the comment, because you're the only thing that I will disagree with you, Ron, Juan, is that you're absolutely right that these grandfather clauses do sell our children's rights and our children's children's rights away, but they also sell our rights away. Because who really trusts? I mean, look, in Virginia, for example, think about the bill, the first gun bill that was introduced, Senate Bill 16, by Dick Sasslaw, who is the Senate Majority Leader, who I know drafted this bill in consultation with folks from the governor's office, because this was going to be the vehicle to move through the legislature. And it had no grandfather clause. It was simply Mr. and Mrs. Virginia, turn them in, destroy them, but you can't have them. right? Not your quote-unquote assault firearms, not your quote-unquote high-capacity magazines, not your suppressors, not your trigger activators. Can't own any of them. Then we saw that hue and cry across the state of Virginia. The Second Amendment sanctuary movement sprang forward, and you started seeing these counties say, well, hell no, I'm not going to do that. And what was the response? Well, you're right. I'm gonna pull this bill down. This was the dumb idea anyway. We're going to have another gun ban bill. And we get House Bill 961, which is virtually identical to Senate Bill 16 with one exception. There is now a grandfather clause for those owners of so-called assault firearms, as long as they register themselves and their firearms with the Virginia State Police to say, hi, here I am, and here are my guns, and here's where I live. Even though you just told me you want to take my guns away, or at least you don't want me to own them. You want me to hand them over. So why would I trust that a grandfather clause is going to be around as long as most grandfathers are and not just be legislated away in the next legislative session? Again, we've seen this actually in California with their magazine ban. Back in 1998, California law changed, and no more could you purchase magazines that could hold more than 10 rounds of ammunition. But those gun owners who currently possess these magazines could continue to possess them until California law changed again in, 2018? And they passed a bill that said, anybody who owns these magazines, who've owned them for 20 years, yeah, now you got to hand them in or you got to destroy them, but you can't have them. So they went back on their grandfather clause 20 years later. In Virginia, I have no doubt that if House Bill 961 passes with this grandfather clause, that the very next year, there'll be lawmakers in Virginia who will be filing legislation seeking to revoke that grandfather clause. And by the way, there's still no grandfather clause in Virginia's House Bill 961 for magazines, for suppressors, for trigger activators. It's only for those so-called assault firearms. So, one, you are absolutely correct in that these grandfather clauses, the problem with the grandfather clause is that it still turns a right into a privilege. Even for these current owners, right? The position of a grandfather clause is, well, nobody can own these things except people who already did. And we will allow them, we will permit them to continue to possess them, but they don't have a right to do so. We're allowing it. Well, you don't allow a right. You respect a right. So, yes, Juan, you are correct about grandfather clauses, and I appreciate you writing in, and I appreciate you as a fellow Virginia gun owner doing everything you can to try to push back against Ralph Northam's gun control agenda. Let's see. Also, from Luke, writing in about Lobby Day in Virginia, he said, you know, the media and the Democrats promised that there was going to be violence in Richmond this past Monday, but instead we saw well over 20,000 people peacefully assemble to lobby their politicians. There wasn't even trash in the streets, says Luke. And you could see that in all the video that was broadcast after the event. He said, instead, the real massacre happened on Wednesday with the passage of the red flag law that does nothing more than violate the people's rights. So I guess the media is correct. Massacres will continue in the state of Virginia as long as there's a political party in power hell-bent on doing so. You know, Luke, so since Luke wrote in, by the way, we've not only seen passage of Senate Bill 240, which is the Senate version of red flag legislation, but we've seen the House version advance as well. And those two bills are very different. So it remains to be seen. Now, listen, I'm a realist. Okay. I'd love to be able to blow smoke up your rear ends and say, you know what, everything's going to be fine. We're going to see some really bad bills become really bad laws. But there is something that is worth keeping an eye on as these bills start to cross over and then go back to their house of origin. And you got these differences between the House and the Senate versions. There are four Democrats in the state Senate who have said, we're not on board with the current language of the governor's gun ban and his magazine ban. and his suppressor ban. They have voted for red flag legislation. They have voted for one gun a month. They have voted for universal background checks. They have voted for bills that would undo firearms preemption laws in the state of Virginia. They voted for all of those things. But the Senate versions that they voted for differ from the House versions and are not as they're not supportable. I want to make sure I get that perfectly straight here. I don't support any of them, but they're less awful than the House versions, if that makes any sense. So we're going to see a reconciliation fight. Democrats, again, they want to get bills to Northam's desk. In fact, I believe that the Democratic leadership wants to get bills to Northam's desk more than they really care about what's in those bills. So if they need to water them down, they'll water them down. As long as they can say, look, we did something. Republicans did nothing and we did something. That's what they want. They want the PR victory. I don't think much of I honestly don't think much of them care about how effective or enforceable or constitutional these laws are. They just want to be able to hold the press conference. And doesn't matter how many rights are infringed. Doesn't matter how disproportionate the impact's going to be. They want to pat themselves on the back. They want to cut their next campaign commercial saying, we acted. And I suspect that they will go to great lengths to be able to do so. But really what we're watching right now is that reconciliation process start to take place. What are these bills going to look like when they get to Northam's desk? And, you know, honestly, I mean, there's one school of thought that says, all right, well, if all of these are going to be challenged in court, then why not have the worst bill possible? Doesn't that make it easier to challenge the bad laws in court? Now, I'm not an attorney, and there may be some merit to that. At the same time, as a Virginia gun owner, I would prefer to have to live for the next 2 years until we can vote these dolts out of office. I would prefer to live under the least onerous laws possible. And by the way, I suspect that ultimately it's probably not going to be up to us as gun owners. Although I do believe we still need to be contacting our lawmakers, whether we know they support our Second Amendment rights, whether we know that they don't. And again, those few Democrat senators who are saying, listen, I don't want to go after guns. I don't want to go after the things that people own. I want to make it more difficult for people who shouldn't own firearms to do so. And that's the message we're hearing from people like Senator Linwood Lewis, who represents Virginia's Eastern Shore and a little bit of a Norfolk, who has said, I'm focusing on the access issues. That's what he calls them. So that's why he says he backs universal background checks and red flag legislation, and he even backs things like an end to firearms preemption, or at least the Senate version. But he has drawn a line in the sand, he says, when it comes to actually dealing with and taking away the guns that people own. Basically, you know, once you are allowed to exercise that right, if you're not disqualified from exercising that right, if you're not a prohibited person, if you're not somebody who's been adjudicated mentally defective, then you know you should be able to exercise that right in all its glory. The problem that I have with Senator Lewis's argument is that some of these things that he says are access issues that he says won't impact legal gun owners absolutely will impact legal gun owners. For example, the end of firearms preemption would have only an impact on legal law-abiding gun owners because criminals are already in violation of the state's gun laws. So it doesn't matter if they're now in violation of a locality's gun laws. We're talking about making life more difficult for the people who are legal gun owners to exercise their rights long after they've accessed a firearm, long after they've purchased it or inherited it or somehow legally acquired it. That's sort of a long-winded answer to your question about the red flag law. But again, I would say that the important thing right now is for Virginia gun owners to go ahead and maintain contact with lawmakers, be polite, be civil, but be persistent and let them know where you stand. We do have litigation coming. We have bad bills that will become bad laws, but it's too early to know just how many of these bad bills are going to become bad laws. All right. One more from Jim, wondering about one gun a month in Virginia. Jim out in Colorado. Jim says, didn't they try one gun a month in your state before and they repealed it as ineffective? Perhaps a better law would be that criminals are not allowed to buy more than one gun a month from the trunk of a car. That would be about as effective. And yes, this law, one gun a month, was on the books in Virginia from 1994 through 2012, I believe. It was on the books when I moved to Virginia in 2004. Basically, the last time Democrats had complete control of the state government, that's what they put in place. And they did so at the request of Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. at the time had a complete ban on handguns. The homicide rate was sky high, and they blamed Virginia. They said, well, we got these people that are driving from Washington, D.C. down to Virginia. They're picking up, you know, truckloads full of guns, and they're carting them back to Washington, D.C. So we need to curtail that, and we need to implement this one gun a month law. So Democrats in Virginia did. And it didn't have any impact on the violent crime rate in Washington, D.C., or the violent crime rate in Baltimore, Maryland. Other states like South Carolina that had one gun a month laws on the books repealed their laws as well. In Virginia, the provision was, I think it was amended at some point, to exempt concealed carry holders. So if you don't have a concealed carry license, you can only buy one handgun a month. If you do have a concealed carry license, you can buy as many as you want. Right now, in the Senate version of the one gun a month law, there is an exemption for concealed carry holders. So it would just return us to the status quo of 1994-2012. The House version does not have an exemption for concealed carry holders. And so, again, that's one of those things that's going to have to be reconciled between these two bodies. If House Democrats, who I think are certainly pushing a little bit harder for more extreme measures than what we've seen out of the Senate, if they're successful in doing this, then in essence, you are just flat out rationing the exercise of a constitutional right. And I suspect that that will be challenged in court. If they allow that exemption for concealed carry holders to remain, you know, it might make a successful court challenge a little bit more difficult. I suspect it might also increase the number of concealed carry holders in the state of Virginia, and gun control advocates might not want that. So they've got to figure out their strategy here, too. Do we go with a more extreme version that's likely to be overturned by the court, or do we go with a more moderate version that might lead to more people actually carrying firearms for self-defense, which we really hate? It's a conundrum for them, right? All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. And I do want to thank you for being a part of today's show. Don't forget, you can subscribe as a podcast at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, townhall.com's podcast page. You can also subscribe to Town Hall Media at YouTube, and you can become a VIP member of Bearing Arms. Help support the work that we're doing there each and every day. Get exclusive commentaries, analysis, and more. Hope you have a fantastic weekend. We'll be back on Monday with another brand new edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. We'll see you then.